Hello and welcome to Pair Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbow's most familiar work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we are back to talk about the new arc of Pale, one after another, starting with 10.1 and then 10.A. And then, wait, this can't be right, Elliot. 14.12?
I think we skipped a few accidentally.
Yeah. I guess we must have missed a few chapters, so we're just going to catch up and jump straight to 14.12. But let's start with one after another, shall we, before we get to the later chapter.
Yeah.
So in Avery's head, Avery and Snow are doing some final preparation for the familiar ritual, choosing basically to have no circle rather than have a circle. I mean, I guess the theme of a lot of this is, what conventions can we break in this familiar ritual?
Yeah, there was so much setup for the ritual from Rhoda's perspective. Like when we had 9.Z, it was apparently going on while the setup was happening. They just decided not to do anything. This is a very like minimalist wedding. I mean, it's kind of crazy how Snowdrop's the one who's like, I like the moon circle. And Avery's like, Snowdrop, that's the tyrannical one. It like makes me your master. Mm. And Snowdrop's like, I don't know. Whatever, I guess. Just give me strawberry milk. And it's like this absurd amount of trust to put in Avery. And I mean, it's quickly rewarded because Avery's like, no.
Yeah.
But like, it's just this moment where I was reading it and I was like, what?
Yeah, it definitely gives a bit of weird vibes, doesn't it? It kind of made me question this entire thing to an extent. Like, obviously this is something Avery wants to do to extend Snow's lifespan, and Snow is obviously kind of on board with that, I guess.
And she's also sort of reached their age because she's aging so much quicker than the other Kenneteers. Yeah. It's like, it is a kind of cool time to do it because if you're going to tie their lifespans together while they're about the same age, seems like the time to do it.
Yeah. But it might be worth examining the idea that Snowdrop is kind of just going along with this because Avery wants to do it. Like, first of all, there might be a point that Snow is too, in air quotes, young. I would say kind of like mentally underdeveloped, yeah. I guess, to consent to this at all. Or even just kind of more subtly, Snowdrop thinks she might want this, but what she really wants is just to kind of go along with things because Avery has suggested them. Like, I don't know. I'm not at the point where I would get upset at Avery for this. And Avery is obviously doing a lot of like confirming that this is all what Snowdrop wants and confirming that they're doing things in a way that is chosen as much as possible by the two of them. But it does kind of just feel like Snow's being like, yeah, whatever, let's go along with this, which is just giving me slightly weird vibes.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like she's taking it as seriously as she maybe should be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you could definitely make that argument if you needed to. I agree. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think Wobba would have Avery do it if that was the case, because she's usually pretty good at looking out for that sort of thing.
No, I agree.
So, yeah, I don't know, but like I see what you're saying. Like, there's absolutely something there.
Mm.
There's a comment by Jude which sort of lightens the mood after this weird moment with Snowdrop where she doesn't take it seriously, where Jude's like, you guys are weird, and then they just make fun of how he's dressed, which is a bit of a theme for the chapter, the Garrick's dressed weird.
We'll get to the Garrick's a few times, I think, this chapter.
Yeah. But I like a lot of these decisions that they make. Like, the idea of not having a circle is such a great expression of, like, you know, I think we first called it out when Avery had this idea of doing the ritual on the paths. It's like such a great way of not over-enforcing the Avery aspect of Snowdrop. Like, we want to acknowledge that she's more than a part of Avery. She's like part of the paths. And so literally not even drawing a line between themselves and the paths is like drawing both of them into the paths in a way that is like Avery giving as much as she is, you know, sort of tying Snowdrop to her. She's also helping tie Snowdrop to the paths. It's just cool.
Yeah, I think it's good. And again, something that Avery is doing to make sure that Snow has like an equal claim to their relationship, which is good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Even if Snowdrop is apparently not...
unconcerned with that, yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's something that started to jump out to me yet, and I don't feel like I have the second half of this like to tie it into a cohesive thought, but like at the start of this story, Avery was so obsessed with places, or so obsessed with people and belonging and like her relationships with people. And she shifted more and more into just being worried about her relationship with spaces. Like Ken is equipping her with that pin that tells her how much she belongs in a place. Obviously she ties herself to the paths here. I don't know, I guess with her whole revelation about being somebody who like is arrivals and departures, she's almost shifted herself more to being the person who can be where she needs to be, not with who she, I don't know. I don't feel like I've taken this idea anyway, but I'm just noticing this trend in that, like, Avery was always a traveler, but it's like there's been this shift in focus to her making sure she belongs in places.
Yeah.
Like, I guess, like, spoilers for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, I guess, people haven't watched that, but, like, I always liked how that ended.
It's a great show.
I always liked how that show ended because it was, like, the moral of the story was that Rachel needed to stop throwing herself into relationships and fix herself first.
Yes.
And, like, when Avery started, I think we actually talked about the ending of that show, like, in arc two, because it was sort of like, this feels like the obvious place to take someone like Avery. Which sort of means Wabo's probably going to do something more nuanced than that. And, like, I think it's interesting how Wabo's maybe just reframing her around not valuing herself by
romantic relationships.
Yeah, and by other people's opinions as much. She's learning to, yeah, I guess, tie herself to places and you know, understand her relationship with where she is, not who she's with.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously earlier on in the story, a big thing for Avery was this kind of revelation of there's nobody for you in Kennet, right? But it really, that seems to really have taken a backseat in the story recently. I wonder if we're going to come back to that and kind of close it out with Avery kind of realizing that's not really a big deal. I don't know.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see.
I kind of feel like she already has realized that, but it's not the kind of realization that she's like voiced or anything.
Yeah. I'd agree with that. Also, she doesn't swear Snowdrop to the seal, which again is just like another nice little moment of how much we're respecting Snowdrop. Because like, how would Snowdrop work with the seal with her whole always saying the opposite? Like,
yeah.
Would it, like, either she'd just still get to do that and it would be sort of fine, or, you know, it'd like flip her around and sort of take a core part of her identity. Although I suppose it's up to Snowdrop whether it's a part she wants to hold on to. But I guess my favorite thing about this is that's not even cited as a reason that Avery doesn't want to put Snowdrop on the seal. Like,
well, that's a very utilitarian reason, which I think is something that Avery's not really considering, right?
Well, it's a very specific to Snowdrop reason. Like, I think that, like, Avery's thought here is the seal is being used in bad faith. And it's like, we don't want to lean into something that doesn't seem to be working anymore. And it'd be very easy to then also say, oh, yeah, and, like, with Snowdrop, how's it going to affect her contrarian nature? And then that makes it a much more, like, Snowdrop-specific problem with the seal, whereas, like, we don't address it because it's much more, like, the seal as a whole is broken, and, it, like, who gives a shit about Snowdrop's particular thing because it's still wrong anyway.
Yeah.
Like, in a way, it almost means more that it was someone like Snowdrop and we still didn't bring up her specific interaction with it.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I wonder. I wonder what would happen. I mean, I guess it's just not a consideration because swearing Snowdrop to the seal isn't ever going to happen, so we'll see.
Yeah.
I just kind of wanted to point out as well, because we're here doing the kind of doing this familiar ritual with everyone kind of gathered around being friends, it's just so much fun having all these people here hanging out, you know what I mean? Like, this is the biggest combination of Avery's, you know, building connections with making friends with people. And it's just so joyful having this big group interacting. E.g., there's a moment where Liberty has a water pistol while Cherry Pop is, like, crying and carrying onto her ankle.
No, that's when she's picked. Wait, this is from the end of 9.Z's extra material. This is the bit where Liberty's trying to put Pekka Snot on the scales. And Cherry Pop's upset because she wasn't funny. You're right. It's great. Like, it's a nice moment to sort of bring us into that extra material and also just reemphasize how much Avery has brought everyone together.
Yeah, she has. And this is a great manifestation of that. Snowdrop invites more of her own guests, and although Miss can't make it, some other random lost kind of step in and help balance out the numbers.
Yeah, it, which is a nice moment. I mean, I was sad about Miss because they were so easily able to do it in 5.D that when Avery started, yeah. I was like, oh, sweet. And then she didn't come. And because it was so easy for her in 5.D, I'm like, what does this mean?
Yeah, it's worrying, isn't it? It implies that because it was so simple, something's going on with Miss. But maybe it's a good sign. Maybe it means Miss has been on an adventure that we'll get to see in another interlude at some point.
No, she's not on the paths anymore. It's just when she got off them, she landed in, like, Japan, and she's still making her way back to Kennet.
Or she's busy driving to Kennet to pick up her daughter, Verona, because Miss is actually Verona's mum. Whoa, what if it's that?
Yeah, I mean, the other... it could just be something as simple as, like, the promenade is one that seemingly integrates a lot of Lost into itself. Like, anyone who shows up becomes... Or anyone who steps across that threshold can become, like, they're beholden to the rules or whatever. So maybe...
Yeah.
Maybe that's too close to a label for Miss or something. I don't know.
Yeah, true. Could be.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, the promenade's interesting, isn't it? We really do get the sense that this is just a place where Lost from other parts will come and chill out and hunt for a bit before going back to their normal day jobs.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a promenade. Yeah. It's
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll definitely be talking about that a lot as we go through, I think. Also, just while we're talking about all the other Lost who are in the ritual, I just love how everyone feels like they have a whole story behind them. Like, there are just all these others that are described here in the text, and it's just like you can picture this entire backstory. Like, it's like Clem and her items, where it's like every time Wild Bow can include Clem, he just drops these little tidbits of items that feel like there's a whole story behind them, and it's the same with all these Lost.
Yeah, I really loved the... I'll just read this one out, actually, because I think it's so great. There was a spider crammed into a business suit, somehow maintaining the angles that made up the suit. Somehow maintaining the angles that made the suit look like a person was inside it. One spidery leg reaching up to hold a bowler hat up roughly where it should be. What a great image that is, a spider like desperately trying to pretend that it's somebody in a business suit.
I'm off to do some business. Excuse me.
I want to know more about this other because it's so fucking funny as an image.
Yeah, but like that was my response to almost all of them. Is that like every time someone came on, I was just like, "Oh, this is great!" Like it's just that ability Wildbow has to be creative and imaginative with each of these that it feels like there's so much to them. And knowing Wildbow, there probably is. He'd probably be ready to write an interlude for any of these if he needed to. Also, some of the Lost who join Snowdrop's side are the smiling kids, which is, sure, why not?
Yeah, these smiling kids come up a lot in this chapter.
They're from the Falling Oak Avenue, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, okay. All right, that takes me back. I haven't read the Falling Oak Avenue. I was going to call it a bonus material, but it's not. It's a Reddit comment.
Well, it's canon by now because we've got the ballerina.
A canon Reddit comment, yes, by Wildbow, but still.
Yeah, well, it's a word of God that has actually become part of the story.
Oh, yeah, because it's like a school area.
Yeah.
That's right. I get you.
I think it's meant to be them. But, yeah. Something we should start to talk about as we're getting into the promenade is in her vows, Avery... in her promises... Avery calls out that Snowdrop was made for the Forest Ribbon Trail and that she was planning to sacrifice her, and she's so glad that she didn't do that. And like, I've seen lots of people talking about this on the Discord and stuff as well, but, like, when you view the Forest Ribbon Trail through that lens as kind of baby's first path, like, it's the first one they send them on, the first thing you do as part of your first path is find a creature, turn it into an other, and then sacrifice it to the wolf. It really sets this bad tone for your relationship with the Lost when it's like the first thing you do is make one and then like kill it to save yourself. And like, I'm just sort of looking now as the Forest Ribbon Trail as this path is very much one that's like, it's this journey of self-discovery, but it's very much an isolated, like, selfish path, I suppose. Like, you go there, you sacrifice others, you have to not rescue the other ones. Like, they were all just begging Avery for help. I mean, well, there was that one guy who tried to lay eggs in her or whatever, but it, like, you just compare that to the promenade, where this is one where it's like you walk around, you meet the others, and you can just, like, Avery just chats to a bunch of them. Like, it's, I hope this path gets to the point where it can become Baby's first path, because it's one that, like, you work with other finders, you work with the others, you meet them in this context. Like,
yeah.
I remember something, I'm pretty sure in Falling Oak Avenue, the ballerina was like, sometimes she's evil, sometimes she's just fine. And I can't remember if there was a rule associated with that, but I wouldn't be surprised if some of it's just your reputation as a finder. And so it's like, you go to places like this, you meet the others as people first, and then you'll probably have an easier time on the other paths because you've respected them as people.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to think about the idea that the Forest Ribbon Trail as like the first path for a finder really sets the expectation for new finders of, you go there, you make an other that you explicitly sacrifice. Like, others are tools that you can use to get ahead in your paths, yeah. Right? That's the moral of that
story. Well, and the other ones are either tricksters or they're the wolf. Like,
yeah.
So on the other side, it's saying the ones who aren't under your control are going to be trying to trick and sabotage you and hurt you.
Yeah, but rather than have the promenade become the first path, I think if there's a way to consistently depower the wolf and make it less of a threat, having the Forest Ribbon Trail become the first path where you go in there, you make a boon companion, and then you don't sacrifice them, you keep them as your like companion. Imagine how great of a first path that would be for finders of like, this is a path about creating and forming a long, like a solid relationship with an other that you will then have as your companion. Like a light kind of familiary ritual that's a bit more friendly. I think that would be a great way to get finders on the right path, so to speak.
I still would think you could start with the promenade and then move into this journey that turns into self-discovery and you leave with a lifelong companion. But I just love the idea of the promenade being first, because it's like, it's respecting the lost as kind of people much more, because it's like, before you start exploring their land, you go to like the closest thing they have to like a central home, and you sort of meet them on much more their turf, the community turf, and like you have to go with other finders. I mean, that's the other thing as well, is like, this is much more of a team based path from the finder's perspective. So also just if you're going to rope your kids into being finders, go somewhere you can go with them for the first time. Like, this is just a parenting tip for all you finders out there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's a good point. It gets them off on the right track.
Yeah, and again, like the promenade, I think we said this way back when it was introduced in the 9.3 extra material. It's such a perfect path for Avery, just as this person who is so obsessed with understanding, like, or, you know, connecting with people and treating them as people. It's like, and one that's built around cooperation and teamwork, which are big themes in both of these next two chapters. It's such a perfect path for Avery to understand instead of the Garrick's.
Yeah, I agree. So we cut ahead to the actual start of the path. Avery and her husband to be Jude are watching his cousins kind of start their explorations, and I guess it's worth us touching on the thought of like the fact that this chapter jumps back and forth a bit, at least in the first half. We're cutting back to the ritual and ahead to the path so that they're kind of happening concurrently.
Yeah. We're cutting like back and forth. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious why, I'm trying to think like, why did Wabo decide to do it this way? I mean, like, my gut reaction would be he was worried that the familiar ritual would be a bit too dull to carry an entire part of the chapter by itself, but I strongly disagree with that. So I don't know what it could be.
My thinking is that most of the familiar ritual parts are short cutaways, and I think they sort of directly inform or map to what's happening on the path at that time. Like, obviously, we go from planning the familiar ritual and starting it to Avery planning her trip on the path and starting it. But then from there, it's like each little segment of the familiar ritual we get sort of has its own little theme of what Snowdrop and Avery are promising to do with and for each other. And then you can kind of see that mapped onto the next part of the path. So like the next section of the familiar ritual that we sort of get to after this one is like, they're promising like, oh, we'll give each other everything that we can. And then it's like, the next part of the path is where Avery borrows Snowdrop's sight. So it's sort of like, I think there's like little connections between like, it's like showing us how what's happening in the familiar ritual is going to actually practically apply to what the two of them can do.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. But it doesn't, I mean, I guess it kind of does. There's a point where Avery taps into Snowdrop's sight, which feels like it's leveraging that for sure. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, it is also great for the tension because you get to have all these little mini cliffhangers where it's like, what are we going to do now? Yeah. And then it like cuts back to this really nice moment. But then again, I think like the solutions to the problems they're encountering keep sort of being alluded to in the familiar ritual.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I guess that makes sense. I didn't kind of feel that much, but, you know, whatever. Let's jump into the unhatched egg, because Jude describes this, says, the unhatched egg screams randomly. We don't know what it does yet, but Alexander Bellanger said it was strong, so we keep troubleshooting it. So here's my new fan theory. Alex knew he was going to die soon and used the opportunity to play a great prank on the Garricks by cursing an egg to scream and then telling them it was a powerful artifact.
Yeah, again, this is another thing. Like, these items that the Garricks have, again, like, that's just this creativity Wabo has to build up, like, this whole thing. Like, yeah, I'm sure this egg captured everyone's imagination like yours, because it's just...
It's just ridiculous.
Well, it's an so unhatched silly egg. That's what most eggs are. Like, it's such a weird description for an egg. Like, it's not broken. I love it. Like, what could it possibly be?
Yeah, who knows?
I think, like, as well, because, like, the Garricks talk a bunch. Like, they've got this bingo card as well that drops you onto a random path, which is very fun.
Ridiculous.
And they've got the coupon book. Like, they've got all these things that they've clearly gotten as boons from various paths. And something that starts to come up the more the Garricks talk about things is how much, like, this is their focus of how they analyze the paths. Like, they're thinking about boons, about, like, the symbolism of the place and stuff. Like, when they're talking about the promenade, the only time the others come up is in the context of them being hazards. Mm. And, I mean, I suppose that that's fair, because that conversation is where the uncle guy is preparing Avery to go on there. So it makes sense to only bring up the fact that some of them are going to try and kill her. But there's just, like, the way the family is, like, so competitive and all that, like, you just get this vibe that they just treat this so systematically and, you know, like, bureaucratically. Like, there's no personality to how they're approaching this.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. They're very much just, like, we want to figure out the specific rules to this path so that we can kind of exploit it later, right? Like, that's the vibe.
Well, yeah, but there's so little focus on the others as a part of that. Like, they mention, later on, they're like, some of these are familiar others. So, you know, we should try and keep track of that. But again, that's just in the context of not...
How can we optimize the rules?
Well, yeah, and not even thinking of them as people. It's kind of like, oh, okay, so what does it tell us if these are the ones from Falling Oak Avenue, you know? Like, there's no question, what does this say about them? It's what does this say about the path? So it's like, good thing they brought, you know, Avery of all people to help shake up their thing. Like, I love that moment where Avery's like, I'm going to move like this. And the guy's like, that's a bad idea. And then Jude's like, didn't we, like, the whole point of bringing her is to, like, shake things up. And he's like, this is the wrong way to shake things up. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, good stuff. Oh, they seem pretty annoying. I mean, like, they're not terrible, but they're very annoying.
Oh, yeah, I mean, they have a very toxic culture as a family, for sure. By practitioner standards, not so bad, but, like, by human standards, not great.
Yeah, definitely. We cut back to the ritual quickly again as Snow and Avery start making their vows to each other. And I just kind of want to touch on this, like, Snow's backwards talk here. Is this something to be concerned about? Like... Because Avery's being like, oh, you know, I promise to help you get a foothold into the world of man, blah, blah, blah. Snow's like, no, I reject that. I don't want it, blah, blah, blah. Which obviously is her backwards talk, but, like, I don't know. The spirits, I don't know if the spirits are smart enough to fully grok that without it having some implications, I guess.
I mean, but they're in the paths. These, if any spirits should get it, it would be these ones, right? Like,
yeah, true.
I don't know. I just read it as something that was great for humor. Not necessarily like, yeah, I don't know. I didn't read too much into it. I give the spirits that much credit, I suppose, because they're the ones doing it too. Like in Snowdrop's head, she says what she means and the spirits are then flipping it. It'd be pretty shitty for them to then be like, oh, that's enough. We didn't know about this. It's like, you're doing it, you idiots.
Yeah, I guess that's fair enough.
I mean, I just love these bits. Like Cherry's little comments, like the bit where she suggests Snowdrop is winning is just like, yeah, it's so good. Like there's a really comedy angle to Snowdrop and how she interacts with this, and then Cherry is just the icing on top.
Yeah. So yeah, Avery continues along the path, chit-chatting with Jude and getting some interludes from Jude's family, who continuously imply that they want Avery and Jude to become a couple, which is great.
But it's like it's not even that though. They're just like making fun of Jude because, like, oh, if you stuff up here, you'll look like an extra idiot. Which is just like, everybody knows what you mean when you say that. Just say it. Like, his family are such dicks to him.
Yeah, they're pretty. Again, they're just annoying. They're just like, they're like Sol's mum, right? They're caricatures of terrible family, but in a very believable way.
Well, I think the reason Jude and Avery are actually becoming such fast friends is because it's not dissimilar to Avery's home environment in a lot of ways. Like this way that everyone has to fight for everything. Like, you know, the family setup, whoever stuffs up the worst gets this shitty bingo card that might throw them into a path randomly. Like everyone's teasing and attacking each other verbally, and it's like that's just very similar to Avery's home life, and I think that's why she gets it. Like she's able to just kind of have his back very easily because she's been on the receiving end of this from like Declan and Sheridan and shit. Like, I don't know, I've been saying this since 4.1, I don't like Jude. Like He's obviously a bit of a dork, but he's a nice guy.
Yeah, he's nice.
Or, yeah, no, he's like not nice. He's a good guy.
He's not mean. I don't know.
No, I think a lot of people wrote him off because there was that moment in 4.1 where he tried to hit on Avery. But he pretty instantly just, like, started being friends with her after she said she wasn't interested. I like him. And I think I like that these two are becoming friends because I think they've got a lot to connect over because they're both kind of the shit heels of their shit families.
Yeah, definitely. I think they make a good friendship. I'm shipping them as friends.
Yeah, same. And I mean, what's funny is that I think they're doing that. Like, they both clearly get on, and it's just Jude's family who's misinterpreting it. And I think these two are kind of intentionally just letting that happen. Like, there's this sort of agreement between Jude and Avery that it works out for both of them if their family thinks they're going to get together, so they're just not saying anything, which I think is hilarious. Just let these idiots keep doing their bullshit.
Yeah, that's fine. Just let them keep their own tail on it, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And they have a really interesting conversation here on the path as well, where like Avery goes over what the Forest Ribbon Trail was like for her, and Jude's like, it's not normally that bad, which was, I don't think I'd ever fully appreciated that Avery got like FRT hard mode.
Yeah, it's interesting. Jude obviously implies that Avery's experience was abnormal, so can it influence makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Like he specifically mentions like murder rooms, which suggests that coming from violent, bad places affects the path, which makes sense when you think about how the paths sort of work. I guess it means that the Forest River Trail isn't quite as bad as Baby's First Path. Like when we saw it in 2.9, it was a bit like, why would you send your children on this? This is awful.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, for most families, it's not quite as dangerous.
It's that much
that makes sense.
Less. Yeah. I think Jude is wowed by the amount of time that Avery spent with the wolf as well and asks if she has had any side effects, but nothing really comes out of that conversation. Do you think the wolf showing up here is the side effect? Like, they are more connected, so the wolf can just quite easily show up at places like this?
I think that is a thing. Like, I do think the wolf, part of why the wolf was able to show up was because of Avery, and we'll get to that when she does, probably. because there's some more text around that. But like, I think, you know, Avery talks about, oh, the antler staying up, and there's talk of what clothes she was wearing where she went. But she's also, has she forgotten she's a vegetarian now? Or I don't think she's admitted to herself yet that she's a vegetarian now, but like, that was very much tied to what happened, not just with the Hungry Choir, but with the wolf.
Yeah, true. True.
So yeah, there probably are more subtle personality side effects that we're just not even really clicking on, but I'm sure they're there. I mean, the other thing is this whole conversation starts because Avery's sort of asking, hey, if somebody doesn't have a face or their face is hidden, can they still be smiling and attack me? Which is like a very good question, but it's also clearly inspired by the idea that Miss could show up, which would be heartbreaking if Miss showed up as a smiling other.
A smiler, yeah, man. Can you imagine?
But yeah, I mean, it becomes relevant later with the ballerina, which is obviously Miss tangential in the context of this story. But yeah, just that idea that like Miss could show up smiling broke my heart a bit. She missed the main ceremony, but she's here to get murdery in the reception.
She gets here a bit too late. Yeah. So yeah, Avery starts to lean on this bond with Snow and uses Snowdrop's sight to help guide her in a difficult move. She also enjoys tea with some others.
Yeah. And like, again, that, you know, we get a small cut here to the familiar ritual where they talk about how they're going to always travel together and help each other get to new places. And then it directly leads to them jumping onto this table, which is like a new form of travel here that they discover. Also, Snowdrop punches the smiling guy in the nuts, which was funny.
Classic Snowdrop.
I mean, her sight is so cool. We haven't even really talked about that, but Avery leans into Snowdrop's sight and it's like, she can kind of see around corners. She can see inside piles. Like, it's, oh, like, that's so cool. This is one of the coolest sights we've seen.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I do really like that Avery goes into, you know, animal senses mode. It works really well. I want to touch on the tea that she has with these kind of rule-providing others, because they raise these rules, but they never really play into the story of this chapter, or I guess the next chapter, which almost makes me think, I mean, I'm not super strong on this opinion, but it makes me feel like we're going to come back to the promenade just so this can actually play a bit more of a role, because it does feel a little strange that it comes up and starts to, maybe it's just kind of setting up our expectation that the promenade is going to be more of a puzzle than it turns into when the wolf arrives. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to read into. Like, it's a great discovery by Avery that you can get on this table and get extra rules or information or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, the second rule comes in a bit, because that's the one where she has to be polite to people and she's constantly saying sorry and excuse me. She's running from the wolf, which was kind of hilarious. But, yeah, the other two about, like, the one about getting on the train and, God, I'm even blanking on what the other one was, which shows how much it came into things.
Eat everything that's offered for you, the train, yeah.
I mean, yeah, the train one was actually my theory as to how she was going to get out of this. I thought she was just going to have to leave the wolf and go to a random path.
that would be pretty funny.
But, like, okay, there's nothing to support this theory, but I'm going to choose to believe that you have to eat whatever you're offered, and then she gets offered this nice tart, is like, because something that happens is she jumps up on this table and the first thing she does is like apologize to the others, which you can tell I don't think any of the Garricks would have done.
No, of course not.
But Avery gets up and she's like, oh, I'm sorry. And then they're like, oh yeah, we really loved your ceremony. And she's like, oh, thanks. And like engages with them as people. And then they're like, yeah, sorry, but we do now have to do the whole rule thing. And so maybe they get to influence that a little bit. And so they made the last rule just something nice. Like, oh, here, have a tart.
Yeah.
Obviously, she could go to other parts of the path and maybe get bitten in the ass by what food she gets offered.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd like to think that maybe these tea-drinking others were trying to throw her a bone.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I could see that.
Also,
an example of Avery's connecting with things being, you know, being a boon to her.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. So because the others are sitting or something, they don't have to move. Unsure why these ones were immune.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe because they're part of some kind of rules that exist, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, because obviously they mentioned the stalls don't really count as spaces, which is why we didn't even touch on the gardener who like gave Jude and Avery some free samples. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I just as an aside, I do love how like the humans have to rest for two turns out of six, but the others don't. It really sort of sets this up as a place that belongs to the Lost.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, they're intruding upon this space.
Yeah,
it's interesting. I mean, I wonder what the because the Promenade is a recent discovery, right?
Yeah.
What does the Promenade look like before practitioners come to it? Does it even exist before practitioners come to it? If so, is it just a place where Lost kind of pass by each other and have tea sometimes? Like,
yeah,
I don't know. Is the Promenade effectively the like staff break room for others on the path, and now practitioners have just kind of started infecting it?
I used to sort of think that the paths didn't fully come into existence until human or finders came, but we saw mists going around paths that didn't have people on them yet. So it is odd because the paths exist in this weird sort of superimposed state where it's like, because like when the wolf shows up, everyone's seeing their own wolf, and so it's like what is the wolf experience existence as? Like, does the wolf have its own self-image of itself? Like the paths have to be the same. Everyone is viewing these paths sort of... Well, I think when they all come in together, I think the overall path kind of looks the same. But, like, you know, whenever somebody goes to the Forest Ribbon Trail, it looks very different to the last time. And it's got different others. And it's sort of like they feel pulled into existence. But, yeah, does this core part, like, when nobody's on the Forest Ribbon Trail, is the wolf just chilling? Like, yeah. You're right. There's questions around this. So, like, the Promenade's the same. How much did it exist before? I think the way the paths work, it sort of existed, but how much were its rules in part defined by the fact that the Garrick's found it?
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder. I don't know. I wonder if we'll get that question answered. Maybe when Miss comes back, we'll get a bit more of that. I think it's an interesting question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, to get out of a tight situation, Avery pulls a cool trick by jumping up onto a bridge and getting away before seeing the blue ballerina and going to talk to her.
I love how she taps into Verona's sight too. Just because we got introduced to these gates and it was like, that's so cool. You can use other people's sights. Why aren't people doing this all the time? And of course, Avery does because she's not an idiot. Whereas like, I love how the Garrick's are sort of like, the second she runs into trouble, they're like, oh, so you're going to leave then? Like, pull the escape rope.
Mm.
And Avery's sort of like, I just want to work out the problem. Give me a minute to work with other people. You know, you could try it for once, you idiots. like, and it's such a great manifestation. We talked about this with Alexander's whole thing where he borrowed people's sights with the bird guts. Like, Avery uses this to help get help from others and get their perspective. And like, she ruminates a little bit on Verona's personality when she sees Verona's sight. And it's like, whereas Alexander just used it to like betray people. It's such a perfect tool for Avery to have.
Mm. Yeah, no, it is. It's great. It's very Avery in a way that I really like.
Yeah.
I also think another very Avery moment is the one where Jude is weirded out by her deciding to talk to the ballerina because the ballerina has murdered a lot of finders, but Avery's just like, well, you know, She's a friend of a friend.
Yeah.
Let's go hang out and chit chat.
Yeah. Yeah. And Avery's like, you're cool, right? And the ballerina's like, yeah, it's such a badass moment. Like, I love something we already talked about. Like, this chapter is constantly setting up, like, making Avery look like the biggest fucking badass to the Garrick's, particularly to Jude, who's getting most of this information firsthand. But, like, yeah, it's like, oh man, I saw the wolf for a couple of minutes and it still gives me nightmares. And Avery's like, yeah, I was trapped there for 13 hours. Big same. And she's like, what? And then, yeah, I love those moments in stories where characters just get to talk about their normal lives and it makes them sound like an absolute badass. It's a great trope. It's great for somebody with self-confidence issues like Avery to get to do it in particular.
Yeah, it's very fun. And then there's this great bit of foreshadowing where Jude says, yeah, but would you get close to you-know-what if it wasn't smiling here? Which is, again, great foreshadowing.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, the ballerina starts howling, as do other others, and it sounds like something is coming. The wolf arrives, cutting off the escape ropes.
Yeah, and so, interestingly, the ballerina does sort of say
yes.
The wolf is here because of a rule.
rule. Honestly, it's a punishment for them doing something wrong, seemingly.
Yeah, I mean, Avery needs to work on how she asks questions like this. She keeps asking, like, compound questions and stuff, and it was very, like, it made it harder to understand the ballerina's responses, but,
yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, you mentioned earlier, like, I think the fact that Avery is so connected to the wolf and they're clearly not done with each other felt like it had to be a factor in the fact that the wolf was able to show up. But, like, what would that rule be? Definitely something to keep in mind. I'm almost positive we're going to be coming back to the promenade again in this story.
Yeah.
So that's going to be something to keep in mind, is can her and the Garrix figure out what the fuck...
What caused the wolf to show up? Yeah. But,
like, again, the fact that Avery came from Kennet again, like, you know, we talked about how that fucked up the Forest Ribbon Trails. Like, the fact that her and a bunch of other people, like, I don't know how much this only applies to participants, but, like, at least her and some of the others in the waiting area, if they count, they all came from Kennet. So things like the wolf showing up, that smiling kid being around the corner, like, these are all little things that feel like the same thing that affected her Forest Ribbon Trail run coming back.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, well, I guess we'll see. I don't know. But yeah, this chapter kind of jumps up obviously a lot when the wolf gets here.
Yeah.
The wolf is a great antagonist, has been on Avery's mind this entire story, and it's so good to have a run-in with the wolf that we'll get to next chapter.
Yeah, I mean, obviously a lot of people have said this is a very video gamey path, and the wolf has big final boss vibes. Like, just in every way, she sort of set up, like, all the other evil others are celebrating her arrival or their arrival. I'm unsure what pronouns we should be using for the wolf. I think they, them.
Yeah. Who knows?
But, yeah. I mean, I have to ask them to clarify, but I don't want to because I'm worried they'd kill me.
I think, I mean, it depends on whose wolf it is, right? So we could just kind of use any pronouns, I think, seems appropriate.
Yeah, that's fair. But, yeah, no, it's like... We'll get into this as we see the wolf more in action next chapter, but, like, it's such a perfect final boss, not just for Avery, but, like, because, well, we've already talked about the promenade is so perfect for Avery because of everything it stands for. So the wolf as an antagonist for Avery also makes it the perfect antagonist of, like, the promenade. Like, the promenade is the social place where all of the others are gathering and, like, working together, and the wolf comes in, just starts killing random lost. It's, like, trashing the place. Like, it's ruining things for all of the other lost as much as it's trying to attack the finders.
Yeah.
It's not
an other that's kind of working into this system. It's explicitly there to fuck shit up.
Yeah, like, it doesn't obey the rules. It's just breaking everything away. It's so toxic, and, yeah, it's everything that Avery and this path are kind of the opposite of. So it's like a great final boss vibe. Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff. Shall we get into the boss fight?
Oh, we have to cut away first, because that's what the story did to us, meanly.
But I think it was worth it.
Yeah, it was.
As we go into one after another, 10.A, which is from John's perspective. Our interlude begins with some army types closing in on a captured person of interest, overhearing this person being interrogated by some other army types.
Yeah, we sort of open with the pack stalking its prey. The story takes a bit to tell you that it's John, but I'd be surprised if most people didn't guess well before the story tells
you. Well, yes. As soon as it feels like we're in an active war zone, you can kind of put together this is John.
And also, like, we talked a bunch about how the header images sort of relate the perspective to one of the Kenneteers by just taking them out of it but using one of their backdrops. This is the first one that's edited, though. It's not just the Lucy backdrop, it's got the inky blotches on it, which is just like, well, first of all, it's mean because it reminds us of the bad thing Alexander did. But also, like, that threw me for a loop when I first saw it, because I was like, after the way 10.1 ended, the fact that we weren't going into, like, an Avery focused interlude was like, what? But it's very much like it. Like, I think the reason Wabo felt the need to maybe edit this image when he hasn't done that in the past is because even though, like, John is much more generally associated with Lucy, what this chapter is dealing with, what John's talking about in it, is very connection group focused. Like, it's much more Avery. So we sort of edited the image a bit because it's like he's cut off a bit from Lucy, even though he's primarily a Lucy thing. And, like, it is a much more thematically, it touches a lot more on some Avery stuff than another John interlude might have.
Well, I would even go so far as to say this chapter is kind of reckoning with what Alexander did to sever the to kind of inkily sever the connections between Lucy and John, right? So
yeah.
Seeing the ink-stained header is very much like this would kind of even be a Lucy-style interlude, but for Alexander's fuckery.
Yeah, exactly. It helps lean into the fact that even if thematically John ties in a lot more with Lucy,
yeah,
like he's been cut off from that now, and like yeah, I think thematically this does tie in a lot more with Avery sort of stuff because like John is so focused on the fact that he, or yeah, like cooperation and teamwork. Like he you know references the fact that he doesn't have a pack anymore. Like he thinks in terms of like that the dog pack metaphor once or twice, and I'm definitely going to use it a lot today.
But yeah, so as soon as we figure out it's John, we kind of know that we're going to see some brutal violence, and this chapter really delivers. It's very horrifying watching the transformation of John from effectively a mindless killer to the kind of gentle dog that we know him as. This chapter, I mean, effectively starts with John starting to gain awareness going down that track, right? For all we know, before this chapter had begun, John just was a mindless killer.
Yeah, and the prose shifts as he gets kills. Like, like early on in the chapter, like the opening of the chapter is so factual. Like, the snow was doing this. It had been doing it more often. Like, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Wobbo puts in just enough color so that it still reads well. But it's so matter of fact. And then after he kills the guy he gets his eyes from, which we'll get to in a bit more detail in a bit, it's like he then starts ruminating on what life means and stuff. Like, you see throughout the chapter his evolution in identity and consciousness.
I mean, like, I guess we're going to touch on the morality of John a fair amount throughout this chapter because I think it's quite interesting, but I guess we can get to that as he starts to gain some of these bits and pieces. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting though, because this is what I got really excited for the second I realized it was John as well, because it was like we talked about this when we were talking about the morality of others who need to kill. Like, I think it was early in Arc 9. But I remember bringing John up as an example of, like, he has to kill people to get identity. So what do you do about early form dogs who need to kill someone to stop being mindless animals, but also we probably don't want them to kill people? And we sort of brought that up. And so, like, it's really cool to think of extensions from that question now that we've kind of seen the process in action. And it's just about as horrifying as you'd expect it could be.
We will start getting into that as John starts getting kills, I suppose.
Yeah.
The stealth team starts taking out their opponents, and as these soldiers die, John gains his name and a pair of eyes.
Yeah, and, like, his sad eyes have been the thing that, they were the very first thing brought up about him in 1.2, is that he had sad-looking eyes. And it's like, so seeing the origin of these is just kind of tragic.
It is tragic, isn't it? It's horrifying. I mean, the people that these soldiers that are about to die are discussing how they effectively hate their time as soldiers, and then they die in very undignified ways. Plus the dogs of war, this group of dogs of war is they're so creepy. They're like these, like, you know, I imagine what this would look like from the other side, and it's effectively an episode of the Magnus Archives, right? Like, these horrifying monsters stalking soldiers in a battleground and silently, stealthily just murdering all of them. I mean, it's a horror story, but we're just seeing it from the monster's perspective.
You could easily build like a horror movie around a group of dogs of war attacking soldiers like this.
100%.
If we hadn't been so familiar with John and been like, okay, we kind of know where this is going, it easily could have been played as like just an absolute horror movie, like on the level of 1.Z. If somebody wrote a movie using Dogs of War as horror movie villains, like, it'd work fantastically. The concept of how they kill you to take of you, and then it's like, so they kill your friend and then they use their eyes and their knowledge to try and kill you, like, that's fantastic horror.
Definitely. We learn what John's nickname, his code name used to be, Carnivore, and the fact that John has always had a mouth has some pretty disturbing implications tied with that.
Wait, doesn't he only get a mouth later in the chapter?
Wait, no, he had a mouth, didn't he? Or am I thinking of someone else?
I think you're thinking of Horseman.
Maybe I'm thinking of Horseman. Maybe I am. Maybe you're right. My mistake.
Because I just remember still, John is surprised he has a mouth when he wakes up after the explosion.
Right. Okay. My bad. Anyway, carnivore has some horrifying implications, yeah. Doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it's so interesting to explore this idea that, like, before they are, like, granted pieces of identity by the universe, like, this idea that the universe says, okay, good job with those kills, have a name. Before that, they try to give each other bits of identity to work together. So things like, yeah, carnivore, like, and you can see, like, all of the ones who don't have their own names. So many of their things are, yeah, these evil things, like carnivore, where Yulda gets a nice one like songbird, but for the most part, those with lesser identity seem to get these more violent nicknames.
Yeah. Interesting.
I mean, something else I noticed, I just wanted to bring up, like, so Angel here gets a mouth, and she shoots the guy who she gets the mouth from in the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, when it first happened, I was like, oh, John's going to get, like, a heart from this guy, because he shoots his guy in the heart. And he thinks he gets the eyes from the guy, because he gets that guy's sad eyes.
Mm.
But, like, and I guess, like, at first I was like, oh, that's just because he covered the eyes. So it was, like, because he covered them, they became what was important in the kill. But also, like, I don't know, the way he gets identity, the way the sadness of the eyes stay with him, I think, like, this is the moment where he starts to get, like, a conscience, I suppose.
Yeah, interesting. He gets the heart of this person, metaphorically. Bit, yeah.
Like, maybe more maybe than even... he would have if he'd shot them, like, you know, in the head. And again, like, it really emphasizes why he tried to shoot Alexander in the head, I suppose. You got to get that headshot so you get their mad augur powers.
Yeah. Interesting.
Like, I think the way they get the kill affects how they get the reward for it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And what they get from it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a fight breaks out, and the dogs start to pretty easily slaughter the soldiers. John dies once and prepares to attack again before being put down, and the practitioner is freed. And that really turns the tide here, doesn't it?
Yeah, pretty comprehensively. It's really cool seeing, like, how John's sort of immortality works from his perspective. Like, he just doesn't function like a human. I suppose we'll wrap back into this more at the end of the chapter, because it's really what this chapter's talking about. But, like, you can see here how he has no choice but to be stuck in this cycle, because he can't escape it. He can't die.
Yeah.
And we touched on this, like, probably half the story ago. I remember we had a discussion about how John's story probably won't end with him just, like, doing the sacrificial play like Lucy was worried about, because it's like that's... It's a bit of a trope for the hero soldier character to die that way.
And yeah.
In this chapter, we start to explicitly set up, even if he wanted to, and in fact, he kind of does, that's not an option for him. He can't do the heroic sacrifice, because he does it and then he just gets brought back so he can do it again.
Yeah, if anything, the heroic sacrifice leans into him coming back.
Yeah, like it's, exactly.
He has to break the mold in order to change what happens, I guess.
Yeah, and it's just so interesting. Like, that's such an even cooler way of setting up what we talked about, this idea that him dying that way would be kind of tropey and boring. It's like Wabo is really establishing here. He that's just not an option for him.
So John wakes up to his compatriots being tortured and bound.
Yep, because this practitioner is actually scary as hell.
Yes, we... I don't know. This practitioner is interesting. There's no moral victories in this chapter, huh?
Yeah. On the one hand, this guy is, like, if you take the average dog, and especially think about them in their early lives, you can almost be like, well, this guy's doing a good service. But then he also mentions, oh, yeah, my family, we help feed these wars so that we can, like, get things like dogs, and it's all in service of War, who's our patron. And it's like, wow, way to turn the monsters who are literally killing people to steal their identity into the good guys. Like, yeah, everyone feels like a loser here.
Yeah. Interesting. There's this bit where the blast dog, I think his name is Ribs,
yeah,
tells the practitioner, like reveals stuff to the practitioner while there's an innocent in the room, and John kind of instinctively is put off by this. It's, I think it's very interesting because we kind of know that others have these other senses, but like instinctually, without ever being told it or taught it, they have this instinctive understanding of like indoctrinating an innocent is dangerous and bad and costs you the protections that keep you safe. I just think it's so fascinating. Like being an other must be so fascinating in this world.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that's only a thing because of the seal. Like it's not a natural part of the order of things, right? Like it is something that the Seal of Solomon said is the natural order of things. And the seals just become so pervasive that that's kind of just becoming true. Like, you know, mechanically in universe, I could see there being reasons of it's like, oh, because John and the dogs are like built up of innocence, like, you know, because they're built up, they're a mosaic of people. It's like, oh, well, when you get built up of innocence, like people who were protected by the seal, that kind of, you've just got a bit of a seal in you that way. But yeah, it's like this real statement on how like the seal has just become the default, and like, yeah, like others are now having to be born with instincts about it, because I guess like in a Darwinian kind of way, if they weren't, they'd just pretty instantly tank their karma and die. Like hell, even Cherry Pop seems to mostly get karma, which is proof of like how fucking everyone can understand it if you're an other.
Yeah, interesting. I like the idea that because they're composited of innocence, that adds to it. I kind of wonder though if it's just like that's just what being an other is like. You just have this instinctive understanding.
Yeah, I think there's probably some of that. And that's interesting that the spirits feel like that they need to do that to the others, because, again, like innocents are apparently a fairly artificial construct that have only been around for a couple of thousand years. So it really says a lot about how much these things are like the idea that the seal is the default is sort of becoming true because everyone believes it.
Yeah. So yeah, John takes action, but doesn't seem to be able to do much at first, except for scaring the journalist, who is then killed by this practitioner. yikes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, as you said, like, kind of feels like everyone's the bad guy in this fight a little bit. There's really interesting comparisons, I think, to draw between John and Liz here, right? Like, because John is still at the stage in the chapter here where he's just a part of this cycle of violence and he's trying to continue it. And he's going to break out in a bit. But, like, for some reason, it was this moment that made me realize that there was this connection with Liz and that he was born into this violent cycle and he became part of it and killed people. But I didn't feel like I could really blame him for it because he was born into it and, like, made for it. And it was the same with Liz. Like, Liz murdered those girls or whatever, but it was like she was kind of made manifest by all the hatred, so it was hard to blame her for that having happened.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, like, you know, we heard about, they're very similar, but for the one fact that we had known Liz's backstory before we met her, whereas John, we hadn't. And that fact did make such a difference in our initial impression of them, didn't it? Like,
yeah, true. By the time we sort of learnt John had stuff like this in his backstory for sure, we kind of were already in love with him, so it didn't matter as much.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I don't know. I'd just be curious to see if there's more parallels between these two and their journeys, because it feels like it's when John steals enough of an identity that he's able to start making his own decisions that he escapes this cycle of violence. And it kind of feels like Liz was the same. Once she managed to kill the witch hunters and like back away from the really toxic environments she was in, she started to grow as an individual.
Well,
and we haven't seen where that's taking her yet.
You say that it's that John was able to make his own decisions. I don't even know if that's true. Like, John left the war after killing somebody who wanted to leave the war, right?
That's fair. That's fair.
We'll get to the end of the chapter.
We'll get to talk about this for sure. Yeah.
Just touching on this practitioner thing a bit more, just bunch of cool tricks up their sleeve, this practitioner. Yeah. Except for the one trick that would have made a difference, which is not hunting alone.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a theme for the chapter, but like John is constantly going to be lamenting later how he's missing his pack, and this guy was alone, and that ended up being what killed him, kind of.
Yep.
also ribs explosions. But yeah, I mean, you're right. Just like a cool new type of practitioner where they just do shit and you're like, whoa, that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, Ribs does his trick, exploding himself, killing the practitioner. And John wakes up after dying again, and some of his dogs and Yolda are there. John is now in charge with Horseman dead, and John decides to go home.
Yeah, well, I love how this is actually, like, Yolda is technically in charge. They all refer to her as the CO, and she appoints who is, like, the tactical commander. And what I love about this is, like, it's kind of heartwarming that these guys who have been built of the components of the foot soldiers do see, like, Yolda as the person who their responsibility ultimately goes to. Like, it's like, as the people on the front lines, they were probably doing this for, you know, the innocents and the people back home, like their children, their, you know, partners, whatever. And so, like, Yolda is kind of this group's stand-in for that energy. Like, she is the one that ultimately they want to fight for. And so she is kind of in charge, and she's the one who just says, oh, John has nice eyes, which is like, no, he doesn't. But yeah, like, yeah, just kind of heartwarming that they made Yolda in charge and she gets to choose who actually pulls the strings or whatever. But, like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is his first instance of getting a leadership position, and yeah, I don't think it goes great.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess not. I guess we see him later and everyone else is gone, so maybe not.
Yeah, he's ended up alone and having to kill the person he was swearing to protect himself. So,
but let's
mixed success at best, I'd say.
The problem is, though, what is the goal of him going home, right? Because these dogs of war obviously are perpetuated by being in an active war zone. And so when John decides to go home, that is a de-escalation. Like, going to peace, what option is there for a literal manifestation of war other than fading away, right?
Well, and that is essentially, I think, the main question this chapter raises is the second half of this chapter is very much John saying, I need to get out of this cycle of violence and I'm trying to figure out how. And we'll talk about that right at the end when the Sable shows up and what I think that might mean. But, yeah, like, absolutely. He wants to escape this cycle, and he's like, this is him. This is his sort of first attempt here. And we see it doesn't go great. He ends up having to kill Yolda himself because of his influence on her. But yeah, I mean, what's interesting is Yolda is really the one who gives it to him. It's a position of leadership he gets, but he didn't necessarily want. And it's hard not to read into that, given that apparently the same thing is about to happen.
Yeah. Let's go back to the thought of John taking from people he kills, because obviously we kind of knew that, but this seeing it makes it land a lot harder.
But it's much more tangible than I thought it was. Like, I guess we sort of found out Alexander, he got auger powers because he killed him. But I just didn't quite process how much it was very much like you get a mouth because you killed a guy by shooting them in the mouth, you know?
Yeah. And also, like, I think the comparison to the Composite Kid is an interesting one, because the Composite Kid exists as an amalgamation of the people that were taken out from the Hungry Choir. But that's, I think it's interesting to compare my gut reaction to John and my gut reaction to the Composite Kid, because I feel a lot more charitable towards the Composite Kid, because the Composite Kid wasn't actively involved in the murder of the things that combined to make them, right?
Yep.
Whereas John is effectively the same. You know, I talked about this. The John we know only exists because he murdered people who were scared and hated fighting, right? Like, and wanted to go home. John, as we know him as a nice person, is nice because he murdered people who were nice. Like, that's hard to reconcile, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It really is. Like, it's that sort of thing. It's like, okay, if you've got a young dog of war, like John, even at the start of this chapter or before it, what do you do with them? Because, like, what are you going to let them kill people so they can become a nice person? Like, no. But then on the other hand, I'm like, well, it feels wrong to kill them, but we know they have the potential to be a nice person. Yeah, so you're right. Like, I don't know exactly what the answer is there. Like, is it okay to effectively try and kill all dogs as soon as they're born? Like, that doesn't feel right to me, but then also letting a species that seemingly has to kill in order to not be a mindless killing machine.
Mm.
But, like, he can't really abide that either.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know. It's just, oh, God, it's weird. It's it's more confronting than I would have expected it to be.
Yeah, really seeing it in action makes it hit home a lot more than, like, when we've talked about it in the past, because it yeah. feels more tangible now.
Yeah.
I think the other thing to mention from all this, I guess John mostly brings it up a bit later, but a big part of his motivation here for, oh, shit, we need to get out, is Yolda got 11 kills, and he's realizing that being around all of these violent dogs is making her more of a killer. And he's like, we need to get her out of the war. And later on, he and the wolf both connect this to his relationship with the Kenneteers, specifically Lucy.
Mm.
And I hate this, because the evidence feels like it is there for John's internal statement of, like, where he thinks, when I'm around Lucy or the Kenneteers or Yolda, I make them more violent. I bring more pain to them. It's bad for me to be around them. And it's like, I hate that thought, but, like, the evidence kind of supports it. Like, I hate this.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, it's just another layer of crushing cursedness to his existence. Like, not only is he now someone who feels a bit of guilt for his existence and he wants to escape the cycle of violence, but he can't be around others. Like, he can't form the pack that he wants to form, because bringing people in makes them worse, makes them bad things happen to them. Like, and he has justified reasons for believing that.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, I hate it, because it's like, I don't want it to be true, but I think maybe I think it's reasonable for him to believe it.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it is, and that's what's so sad about it, right? Like, it's very fair that he thinks that, because it's true.
Yeah, I hate it.
Yeah. So, yeah, we then come back into the present. John is observing the early part of the promenade stuff and kind of reflecting on Lucy and Bree.
Speaking of heartbreaking.
Yeah, God, isn't it? Like, yeah. So John is just so full of, like, uncertainty. Like, really, the thing that comes across here is how directionless he feels.
Yeah, well, he's trapped, isn't he? Like, because he either is a part of this cycle of violence, he constantly escalates things, adds violence to the world, or he tries to fight that, but in the process dies and hurts the people he's around. Like, he's either hurting people he loves or pushing them away, often both. Like, he wants people around him, but he can't have people around him. Like, he wants his pack. He can't have one. He's stuck in this cycle that he can't escape without hurting himself or others. Like, it's just, his life is such a curse.
Yeah. It's horrible. It really is very sad.
Yeah, yeah.
John sees his wolf and decides to get involved.
Yeah, and, like, I love how this chapter just hypes up the arrival of the wolf all over again, like, as if everyone sitting down to read this chapter wasn't fucking thrilled that this was happening already. It's like, I think we knew it was a big deal to Avery because, you know, we know what the wolf means to her, but, like, seeing it happen here, everyone's like, this is the shit we're saving Avery from. Like, Nicolette starts to freak out, which is like, she wasn't even there for that long, right? Like, all the Garricks go on, like, full alert. Like, it really makes the massiveness of the wolf's arrival hit you all over again.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it really does. When John sees his wolf, we get a description. A man, 8 feet tall, ugly, long trench coat with a lot of pockets, carrying a cane, scraggly white beard all the way down to his navel, wearing a top hat with a card in it. I mean, like, we definitely get vibes that it's a practitioner, I guess. Do you think it's somebody specific, or do you think it's just kind of an amalgamation of, like, practitionery vibes?
Yeah, I just read it as the sort of old white man in power, sort of, like, which is what practitioners are metaphorically and literally in this universe. That's what I read it as, is very much tapping into these ideas of the practice and the way the system oppresses people, and this is like the shitty guy on top. I don't know, like, it's interesting. I feel like the wolf, the more we see of it, the more it feels like the wolf represents, don't know, I can't quite nail it down. Something like self-doubt or fear or something. Like, it seems to choose these forms that are specifically designed to invoke fear in people. And then obviously, like, when you think about what it did in the Forest Ribbon Trail, it was like the final boss of that path that was like a journey of self-improvement. So this idea that it's like everything that's kind of holding you back or something, like, it's it also feels like this manifestation of all the people's toxic tendencies. Like, it really, it tries to sort of poke and prod John and Avery with like the most toxic parts of their self-doubt and stuff. It's like some manifestation of the way fear can hold you back or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or hold you back and make you hurt others.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. God, this whole chapter, it's just so... God, I just feel so bad for John. Like, okay, another thing that happens. There's a moment where John is wanting to get involved and almost asks Lucy's permission to do that. And Lucy says, no, I can't take on that responsibility. And it's just, they're just such a good pair. And I just want them to be closer and get past the stuff that is putting them apart. But it's just so not good. I mean, this chapter almost explicitly says it's never going to happen, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, the bit where Lucy's like, are you sure you should go? And he's like, tell me not to and I won't. And then, yeah. Yeah, it just hurts. Like, every time we see him and Lucy, it's just like, oh, fuck, that would have been so good for them, I think. Although John has his reasons for thinking him just being apart from her is good. But, yeah. Oh, him wishing for it and just not getting it. It's just this, yeah, another layer of cursedness of his existence.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. I remember us saying in, like, arc 2 or 3 how John was one of the examples of others who had, like, the best livelihoods. It was in the context of, like, discussing whether Verona should turn into another, and it was like, John's kind of the best case scenario, and the sad truth is that kind of still feels true, but like, shit. Like, they get such a raw deal.
I mean they do. John has some interesting interactions with this wolf, right? The wolf addresses John by name and it scares him. John is initially kind of running in to attack the wolf, but gets scared. The wolf is one of the very few things that gives pause to John, and so he runs away, kind of trying to into the wolf, but never really getting any serious hits on him.
Yeah, and like, this starts to get very action heavy, so we'll be like jumping forward in leaps and bounds. But I do just want to quickly say before we get into that, like, I fucking love how epic this fight is. Like, the wolf is tearing the place apart. John's running around diagonals, shooting shit. Like, it's a great action scene.
Yeah, it's good. It's very strong, and putting it through John's lens of like needing to perpetuate this cycle of violence is powerful.
Yeah.
There's this bit where John's wolf says, "I won't kill you, Mr. Styles. I'll break you and I'll own you," which is just like horrifying. Like, awful, what a terrifying insight into how scary practitioners are to others.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's really leaning into that imagery. Yeah. Sorry, I'm still just trying. Like, the wolf, like, fear. It's like people's worst fears, and then how they let those control them, or like, you know, turn them into destructive habits or something. It's just what it feels like it's doing here.
Yeah. God. Yeah. It's just, I don't know, this entire chapter just makes me so sad for John. I know I've said it a few times.
Yeah.
So Avery, pulling out, demonstrating how much of a badass she is, yells out to the wolf to distract from John, "Does it bother you that you didn't get me? You had me for that long and you had to let me go." So gutsy.
Yeah, again, she continues to come across as an absolute fucking badass. taunting the wolf, like, yeah. What a hero.
Yeah, it's great. So, yeah, we get another flashback from John, flashing back to when he had to kill Yolda, one of the only previous times that he has been indecisive.
Yeah, because, you know, things had been looking so upbeat for John until now. We really just needed something to crush all our hopes and dreams at this point.
This is really tears at your heart. doesn't it? Like, God, I love John so much.
Yeah, and like he when he puts the gun to Yolda's head, I think she helps. Her like final sort of parting words to him, an attempt at those are kind of look after the others. Killing me will elevate you. Important people are watching. Use the power and position you'll get and carry the burden. Which is just like, again, Yolda's last advice for him was to use his responsibility wisely. Like, it's just, it's crushing. Because until now, his entire life and responsibility had been taking care of her. And it was like, his mission was, you put me in charge, I'm going to protect you. And she's like, as he's killing her, she's like, do this for everyone else as much as you can. Like, it's just, oh, yeah, this chapter.
I think John's dedication to trying to find peace is so noble, right? Like, he considers for a moment murdering Matthew, but then realizes, no, that's just going to perpetuate these cycles.
Yeah.
He's just so good. I don't know.
Yeah, he is able to recognize those instincts as shitty and violent and, like, you know, just lashing out, which is everything he wants to stand against despite being born of it.
Then, you know, John has this moment where he says to Yolda, Destago Tora, which is a Pashto that is kind of like the apple of my eye, a similar kind of expression. So yeah, John is crushed by the wolf and dangles off of the promenade, and the group adjust, bringing out Breeze Wolf, Yolda.
Because apparently that's a good idea.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it works out, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose. But, like, yeah, it's a wild idea as well. $10, it was Verona's. So I love this little reveal we get here where John hangs off the edge of the promenade. Because essentially something that just hadn't occurred to me until this happened was, like, that the promenade was leaning into those five pillars that were brought up in 9.Z, which is, like, obviously, that's why they were brought up in 9.Z. I love how, because it's the paths, it's like interfering with one kind of achieves its opposite. Like, you know, we've got, you hold a clock and that stops time.
Yeah.
When the wolf is holding the cables, that seems to lean into, like, the thread and the fate imagery and traps their fate to being on the paths. So, like, no escape works. And then, like, I think in retrospect, Avery wouldn't have been able to get on a train. And then, yeah, obviously the edge is usually the violence thing. So holding onto the edge gives you this respite from violence, which is obviously very fitting for a revelation in this John chapter, because that's what the dude's after. He wants to not be in this cycle of violence. And here he comes to some revelations when he gets that break. He manages to get here and then unfortunately is forced to dive back in to save the others.
Yeah. I like that. It's very interesting. What a great way for this to all unfold, huh?
Yeah, it makes you wonder how, like, the other pillars might manifest in this place. Like, like the coin. Wait, there's trading. There's the marketplace. So if the coin, if we're using the coin instead of the bow, like instead of nature, paying for things somehow means you don't get them. Like, maybe you can pay to not have bad things happen. I don't know. And the pale as well. Is there some way you can stop yourself from dying? Like, a white space is safe or something? Sure, they would have noticed by now if white spaces were safe, but
yeah, you would hope. I don't know, but it could be. You never know. Yeah, as soon as Bree comes out, it adds so much to this scene, right? Like,
yeah.
One, it builds on this tension and sorrow that we've of having him just seen him kill Yolda, right? But it also immediately, I think as soon as that happens, you kind of know where the chapter's going. We're going to play into the fact that John can kill Yolda to resolve this situation. And I just think that's so brilliant. It just is such a, it adds so much to the chapter in such a tangible, great way.
Yeah, it's really perfect, like, isn't it? Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, this moment where, like, the when they go off the edge, like when he does take the wolf off the edge,
yeah.
The wolf says to him, they'll call you back with a tag, but that will take time, and you're at my mercy in the meantime.
Yeah.
And then Yolda, the exact quote is, "She was free to tear him apart as they fell, a mad, vicious, false Yolda destroying him, everything he tried to stop." It's perfect.
Yeah. My quote that I love from this is, as the false Yolda tears into him physically, also, of course, tears into him emotionally,
yeah,
saying, "This is what you are. Either you'll be a sacrifice or you'll perpetuate the cycle of violence and loss. Whichever you do, whatever you do to those girls, they'll cry and they'll lose more innocence, more childhood. The closer you are to them, the more it will take from them to lose you. And all for causes you care nothing about." Oof. Horrifying, horrifying.
Yeah, because do you remember when the Forest River Trail was first set up? This is like in the rules. It was like, you will agree to spend time with the wolf but not remember it.
Yeah.
And it was like, people who do remember it, you know, come out real bad.
Yeah.
And it was
John doesn't have that option, does he?
No, and you can see that now why. Like, the wolf just expresses all of your innermost, like, all the shit you try to bury. Like, God, can you imagine the field day she'd have with Verona?
Yeah.
Because she just confronts you with all the shit you won't let yourself process, basically.
Yeah.
What a fantastic villain.
Yeah, 100%. So, yeah, John is eventually recalled by the Kenneteers, and they have a brief moment together before John is found by the Sable Prince for a checkup. Yeah, I just kind of want to take this opportunity to say fuck Alexander again.
Yeah.
Because Lucy and John would be familiar another if not for Alexander. Having said that, it is the best way for the story to really give the middle finger to Alexander, to say that his decision to sever Lucy and John was, you know, enacted by having her see John kill him, which is a real classic monkey's paw wish. Oh, yeah. By Alex.
Yeah, that's sort of the one silver lining on this cloud. Yeah. Although, again, like, you know, as we touched on this, and as the wolf brought up very helpfully, like, John being around Lucy, like, I mean, you know, Lucy having this realization that she didn't want to pursue violence and stuff is all tied to Alexander dying, which is all tied to her being severed from John connection-wise. So it's like, again, it just feels like more evidence for this idea that the closer they were getting, the more violent she was going to become. And her having these moments, like choosing to ditch the knives and stuff, is because she's not as connected to him. So it's like, it just continues to hurt, because there's this idea that actually this was, in a way, a good thing for Lucy to not be tied to John. And I fucking hate that, because it would be so good for John. So, this chapter's so cruel.
Yeah. So then, of course, we get to this bit at the end where John and the Sable Prince have a moment and make reference to a bargain that they have between the two of them. And of course, this is specifically here to start getting us to think about where John's allegiances lie. I mean, like,
it's blatant tinfoil bait.
Yes, 100%. Obviously, the Sable Prince wants John to take the Carmine throne, is the implication there. Yep. And John seemingly is asking for something in exchange that we don't know what it is. Maybe bringing Yolda back to life is kind of what is implied by the chapter, but it seems to be far from certain. Do you have any theories what this is, Elliot?
Well, I mean, what's like, yeah, like, this feels designed to make you start getting all conspiracy theorist on it.
Mm.
But really, this didn't tell us anything we don't know. We know John is the choice for the succession. We know that he has some agreement to make things more palatable that he doesn't want to talk about. So, like, it's like all this moment really does is it's the book being like, you should still be tinfoiling about that thing from before. But yeah, like I don't. So yeah, for me, this is just, it's the same question as, what the hell did John mean by they will make the job more palatable for him? Like, is he going to, are they going to remove Kennet from his jurisdiction so that he doesn't have to worry about being close to and hurting people anymore? Or, like, I don't know, the thing I kept coming back to is the big theme of this chapter for me was that John is trapped in this violent cycle and he wants to escape, but for him, he can't.
Yeah.
And, like, becoming the Carmine seems like the opposite of escaping that cycle. So how can the judges help him twist the role into something where he is actually escaping it?
Yeah, I don't know.
we talked about this the other day, but like I was briefly wondering if are the judges setting it up so that it'll sabotage the Carmine role so there just won't be one and they can split that role, like Sable can take it under his wing or something? Or, yeah, I don't know. I have no concrete ideas. It's just, it feels like it's going to tie into, John refers to getting this job as like getting his dues at one point. So like, I feel like the plan might relate to him having a way to escape this cycle. I just have no idea what that could look like because that seems so antithetical to what the Carmine role is.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it doesn't seem to track, does it?
Yeah. So I have no ideas, but I'm continuing to be fascinated by this plot thread.
Yeah.
Because especially like this, I suppose the big thing this does imply to us is that in the context of the finale, like setting up this war over the Furs, we've kind of viewed it as like, oh, the Kenneteers will be versus team like Edith and the other culprits, and then we might have Crooked Rook and Toad Swallow and whatever. And John and the judges have almost been written off as non-entities. Like, oh, they're just going to do this and we will counter it and that will be the end of their story. And this is the first sign that it's kind of like, no, okay, these guys are communicating. Maybe they have contingencies. Like, I've always just seen the judges as useless fools who don't do anything. But like, I guess this actually raises the point now. It's like, they might not be as pushovers by the book nonsense as a crew as maybe everyone's written them off as being.
Yeah, they're not necessarily just going to sit in the background and let other people handle everything, you know?
Yeah, they've made out like they're going to, but maybe that's not fully accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. We'll see, I guess.
Like, I suppose, you know, the Carmine culprits are essentially trying to undermine... Well, actually, no, I was going to say they're trying to undermine what the judges represent, which they wouldn't stand for, but they didn't seemingly give a shit about Bristow, so I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, that's the end of the main chapters. Let's get into our bonus material, shall we, which is 14.12 Far Cry. Now, if anyone doesn't know or is listening to this late, we should point out this was a chapter that Wabo released for April Fools, so it's very ridiculous.
Actually, sorry, we really should clarify as well. We should have done this at the start of the episode. One of our most recent things was also an April Fools.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Our the end of Power Reflections episode, that was also an April Fool's gag. So, you know, our show's not going anywhere, folks. The plans for the end of the show that we mentioned are back on.
I just really wanted to bring that up because it seemed like a lot of people were thrown by the fact it came out on March 31st and didn't quite realize it was a joke. And usually I don't want to explain those things, but it felt necessary for this one. And so sorry for throwing you all by putting it on March 31st, but also you've all been tricking me on April 2nd for years, so just say
payback. So don't worry about it. Everything's fine.
Yeah.
You don't need to worry about us getting cease and desist letters. Anyway, should we go on with Wild Boys April
Fool's
joke?
let's go into an April Fool's joke that worked a lot better.
Yeah. So we're in the future, and in the future, Zed, our protagonist now, meets up with the Kennet survivors to get revenge on the Carmine killers.
Yeah, and this is a fantastic self-parody.
Yes.
Like, you can tell Wabo is channeling, like, a lot of energy of, like, things that suck that he doesn't do in his stories, but he wants to make fun of them by doing it here. Like, there were a number of moments in this chapter that felt like CW shows to me, which very much felt like Wabo, like, taking these things from shitty dramas and, like, putting them into the story here to kind of mock them.
Mm-hmm.
Bits of corny writing. It was absolutely fantastic. Like, there's so many bits that clearly place a cool moment over any sort of thematic cohesion, which is just, like, shitty writing and fanfic 101. Like, I loved it.
It really was, wasn't it? It really was like fan service, I guess, to a really fun extent.
Yeah, but like that worst kind where it's like, you know, people speculating, it was like, oh, the story should do this because it would have this one really cool moment, and then you sort of bring up, yeah, but thematically that kind of shits on everything
it would
the
make
story's
no
doing.
Sense yeah
and it's
yeah.
like yeah but it would be cool right and it's like this is Wabo getting to like show those people how actually no it's stupid as fuck.
Well, unsuccessfully, I would say, because I thought it was great. So suck on that, Wabo.
April Fool's yourself.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is something that I didn't notice on my first read through, which is ridiculous because it's so overt.
Yeah, I was so embarrassed when I finished and people were like, did you notice the Avengers stuff? And then I reread it and it's like, she's literally called a Scarlet Witch, Elliot. What the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, it's really. And there's a point where Zed says to Nicolette, how is your hawk eye?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay. Why, how do we not pick up on this shit? Anyway, they're all Avengers. We have Iron Zed, Hawkeye, Nicolette, Edith is the Black Widow, Snowdrop is Rocket Raccoon, Guillaume is kind of Hulk and Groot and the Winter Soldier all rolled into one, I guess.
Yeah, I think most overtly the Hulk because he's now covered in moss, so he's big and green.
Yeah.
John
as Captain America and Lucy as the Scarlet Witch.
There's also Pekkasnot is Spider-Man is one that I saw brought out very late, which I fucking love because he shoots sticky stuff.
Good on him.
That's funny. Like when I was reading this and missing all of the Avengers parallels that were being shoved into my face, my takeaway from like the list of survivors is I was like, oh cool, we get to see like gritty Snowdrop, like because like even before she came on screen, I was like, if you're gonna do like post-apocalyptic satire of your own thing, what you need is like the cute, young, fun, innocent character being like a gritty edgelord.
Yeah,
and so it was like, I was so excited when Snowdrop shows up. She's got like a grenade launcher now.
Grizzled Snowdrop.
Yeah. Yeah. I like, you know, even like little details like Lucy being the last survivor was nice because, you know, she's the black character and that's a trope that needs to die in a fire of the black character dying first.
Mm-hmm.
So like, it felt like there were nice little reasons for all these characters still being in it, even without just, again, the aggressively obvious Avengers parallel that we somehow missed.
Yeah. They kind of group up and then they go to attack the Carmine Killers. It's Clem's murder truck and Cherry Pop.
I knew we were onto something with these claims that Cherry was red and the Carmine mm-hmm. Pop.
Yeah. I actually went through all our pale predictor responses intending to, you know, make a joke about whoever made the prediction that it was Cherry Pop or the Carmine car. But nobody did, so nobody gets any points for that. Apologies.
I mean, we've definitely joked about it being Cherry Pop, but like, yeah, the closest I saw to anybody guessing the car would be involved was Nintendo45, who sort of claimed that the truck would be used as part of the finale to help stop whoever had the furs, which is kind of the opposite of what's actually happened.
But, yeah, it was actually the car behind the door the whole time.
So congratulations, in a way, Nintendo, for being the closest. You were just far off enough that I think calling you out like this isn't actually making fun of you, but like giving you credit for being in the ballpark.
Yep. So I guess a bronze medal for that. Snowdrop is turned to roadkill before it's revealed that this was all just a dream in the head of Cherry Pop.
I love this as an ending, just as like a...
Yeah, just a way to tie it back.
Yeah, and make it's it good, not it? Just like stupid. Like I kind of respect that Wildbo was proud enough of this that he kind of tied it in so it wasn't completely decanonized.
Well, like, yeah, he made it canon. He made it canonically a dream, which is great.
Yeah.
As well as having it end with literally the oldest trope in the Shitty Writer's book.
Yeah, which is it was all just a dream.
Yeah. Talking about this chapter and how hilarious and silly it is, there is one line that I think is the worst Wildbo has ever written where he says, cans of soda popped at the same time parts of Snowdrop did, which is just like terribly written, yes, but also just like the most horrifying line that was written.
Yeah, it's such a great, like, it's the sort of thing you'd expect from one of those bad writing subreddits where like, like the idea of like, oh, popping can apply to both. This is clever metaphors. And it's like, yeah. The chapter's full of them. You're right. That one is far and away the standout. But there's a bunch of lines like that. Like, I think, is it when, I can't remember who dies. Somebody dies and Lucy, it's like Lucy, you know, was shocked and said, oh, no. And admittedly, it's not read in that, it's not written in that tone, but I totally read it in that tone. Like, it's so good.
It's very silly. I mean, we haven't dived into it too much because it is a joke. So there's not like there's that much to call out that isn't just saying, hey, this is funny, that's funny.
Yeah.
But it is very funny.
Yeah, so. Definitely worth a read if you somehow missed or skipped it.
Yeah, great stuff. Anyway, so before we wrap up, though, let's dive into some Pale predictions, shall we? Predictions that have been left by our community in the Pale Predictor form that you can find linked in the show notes down below.
Yeah, what have you brought for us, Ruben?
I've brought a prediction from longtime predictor, lapsed classicist, just pointing out that both the Wolf and Dickie, the POI in John's interlude, both used quotes, Julius Caesar quotes about the horrors of war as they were putting down John and his squad. And
yeah,
one of the most famous quotes from this is, "Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war," which obviously is so applicable but has not come out. So lapsed classicist predicts that one of the girls will use this quote to empower John at an important moment. I think this is a very straight to the point good prediction. Like, whether or not it will empower John in quotes or not, like, it's just a great literary tie-in that I think will almost certainly make an appearance in some way.
Yeah, I'm really glad that Lapsed Classicist brought this up, because I did my live read and I googled both these quotes to find out they're from Julius Caesar, but I've never seen or read that.
Yeah,
so I had no idea what the quotes meant, and I was dreading having to try and look up the relevance. So when I saw that this was a prediction that kind of contextualized them for me,
classicist had done your work.
Yeah, I was like, oh, thank goodness. So thank you, Laps classicist. Yeah, that Dogs of War quote seems very relevant. Like, it could just be that that's why Wildbow chose it as the source for quotes to pull from in 10.8.
Yes, maybe it's just an illusion that isn't going to come into the story actively, but...
Yeah, I don't know. It makes me want to go and read what this story is about. I mean, presumably it's about Julius Caesar, obviously, but, like, thematically, like, how does it tie into John's journey? Because I don't feel like Wildbow would reference another work twice in a chapter unless it was going to have relevance to, like, you know, is there stuff about cycles of violence in this story? And what does Julius Caesar say about them? I'm realizing as I'm saying this that I probably should have done this before recording, but it's been a big weekend, okay?
So what's your prediction, Elliot?
I put out a relatively simple one from Astrid, who has said that the Sable and the Alabaster maybe had a hand in making Edith's doom. And I largely pulled this one out as well, just because, like, one thing we actually haven't talked about yet is the fact that when John kills Yolda, we do see who was there in Kennet when this happened. Mm. And something that ties into Snowdrop's tiny fans theory that we talked about at length a couple of weeks ago is Edith is not there. The girl by candlelight is.
Yeah.
So this does seem to have been pre-Edith, which fits into that theory about how John might have, you know, set up Edith to die. So Astrid's extra point that Sable and Alabaster might have had something to do with that is definitely an interesting one.
Mm.
Particularly since the girl by candlelight and Edith are so involved in all the Carmine bullshit. Like, yeah. This is one where I don't know if I buy it, but it definitely led me to think of some really interesting questions, which is why I pulled it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it. It's interesting. I think without going into it too much, I think this is an interesting one, and I'm sure we'll have more to say about it in the future.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's the end of our show for this week.
Yep. Don't forget, we're running a discussion question. We've already got some fantastic answers for that one, but if you still want a chance to get yours in, you can head into the Reddit thread for this episode or the last one and answer what you think the next steps are for Verona's home life.
Yes.
Looks like there's a chance we'll see that this week. I mean, it looks like Avery's shit's all wrapped up in a nice little bow now.
Mm-hmm.
Wolf defeated forever. Check.
Yep, check that box. Cross that off. Easy peasy.
Yeah, so yeah, we might get to see some more of Verona's stuff this week, but either way, let us know what you think the next step should be.
Yeah, definitely. You can leave that answer in our discussion thread, as mentioned, which will be linked in the show notes down below. You can also, in those discussion threads, just chit-chat about the chapter or this episode in general. Why not?
Mm-hmm. We're on Twitter. Just search Power Reflections. And, yeah, that's where you can find out all sorts of things, like how the show's still running, when the episode's coming out, all sorts of fun facts.
Yeah. If you want more information on the other shows on the Doof Media Network, you can go to doofmedia.com. you can find all the other shows, including the Doofcast, which we were just on, talking about Dropout, which is a great streaming service that everyone should check out.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun just chatting about all the great shows on that network for an hour. Don't forget to check out Pale in Comparison while you're, you know, they're just getting started. So if you've read Pale and not Pact, now is the perfect time to get into it.
Yes. Actually, one other thing worth mentioning is we also just did our game club on Blue Fire, which you can check out on the Media MD YouTube, on the Doof Media, YouTube channel. But that also means we are about to play Disco Elysium this month. So if you want to join in that, you can head to the Discord by going to doofmedia.com/Discord and joining the community and joining in for kind of play along streams, discussion about the game throughout the month before the stream next month.
Yeah. And if you enjoy these Doof shows, you know, you like the quality and stuff, well, that's all only possible thanks to our Patreon, patreon.com/doofmedia. If you subscribe at the $10 or a month or above per month tier, you get bonus content. So Matt and his brother just released their latest show, which is like actually intellectual and stuff. They talk about real topics like quantum and shit. So if you're interested in some of that, go check it out.
Yeah. While you're on Patreon, why not head over to Wildbo's Patreon at patreon.com/Wildbo, because he makes all this great Otherverse world for us to play in. So, you know, check it out and reward him for it.
Yeah. I mean, without that Patreon, we wouldn't have learned about Cherry Pop and the Carmine truck being the
very
villains.
True. Yep. We wouldn't have got that little teaser for the end of the story. But yeah, thanks for joining us, folks. We will see you next week for the next, presumably, chapters of one after another.
It would be a short arc if...
Yeah, the wolf appears, they take care of it, bada bing, bada boom, let's move on.
See you, folks.
Bye.